Well, we've spent the last several weeks looking at this subject of Christian liberty that Paul begins to address in chapter 8 and then carries through all the way to actually the first verse of chapter 11. The reason he was addressing this subject was because of a question that the people in Corinth had written to him about concerning, can we eat meat that has been offered to idols? And for the sake of review, most of you, I think, know by now that the scene, the situation that was going on was that there was these sacrifices that were being made daily to these idols in the temples. And they would take these the meat of that sacrifice, which happened to be the best cut, and that was to go to the priests. But the priests, there was too much meat for the priests to eat, so the priests would go and they would sell this best cut of meat in these outdoor marketplaces called the shambles. And you could get the best cut of meat at a really discounted price. And so there were those in the church that thought, hey, this is great, man. We can go to these outdoor marketplaces and we can get the best, you know, steak on hand to go home and barbecue at a discounted price. This is awesome. And those particular people felt, you know, hey, what does it matter? Because an idol is nothing. And Paul mentions that in chapter 8. But there were others who thought, you know what? I don't know. Because they felt to eat of that meat there in the shambles that was offered to an idol was actually participating in the idolatry. Now, Paul in chapter 8 tells us that the idol is nothing. And really that it's no problem to eat this meat that's been offered to the idol. There's no problem in it because the idol is nothing. There's only one true God. But Paul, in answering their question, about can you eat meat offered to idol, he also uses this as a launching pad to discuss this whole issue of Christian liberty. And in chapter 8, the focus is that the mature brother and sister needs to show sensitivity to the weaker or immature brother and sister to the point that if it means that I need to forfeit my liberty, that I'll do it rather than causing someone else to stumble. And then in chapter 9, Paul uses himself as an example of this principle and how he forfeited his right, his liberty, if you would, to be supported as a minister because he didn't want to stumble anyone in Corinth and nor did he want to hinder the work of the gospel. Because Paul was running for the prize and he didn't want to become disqualified from that goal and that task. And so Paul uses himself as a good illustration in chapter 9. And then as we move into chapter 10, last week we saw that Paul uses the nation of Israel as a poor example of a group of people who were set free in the Lord, but they had abused their liberty, illustrating that even though we are free, we need to use our liberty wisely. If we don't, we can not only cause other people to stumble, but we can find ourselves becoming sidetracked, getting tripped up. And that was the focus of verses 1 through 11. And that was what we looked at last week, where we saw Israel. God uses them as this analogy, as illustrating that, hey, they were set free from Egypt, from the bondage of Egypt. And they were there in the wilderness, but they blew it in the wilderness. And consequently, they were not allowed to enter into the promised land. And so too, we have been set free in Jesus Christ, free from the bondage of sin, free from the power of the devil. And the Lord wants us to move into that abundant life that He has for us. He wants us to move into that promised life of walking in the Spirit-filled life, Spirit-filled living, being led by the Spirit and empowered and moved by the Holy Spirit. But if we're not careful, if we foolishly exercise our liberty, we can find ourselves getting tripped up and missing out on the blessings that God has in store for us. And Paul mentions there in verses 1 through 11 several things that we need to watch out for that trip them up. He mentions lust and idolatry and sexual immorality, testing the Lord and complaining. And those were the things that we looked at in our study last. These are all the things that Israel fell into that caused them on what had for them. Now tonight, I want us to pick up verse 11, where he says, "Now all these things happened to them as examples. And for our admonition, ends of these have come." Paul says all of these things that happened to them happened as our examples. That these things have been written for us so that we might learn from their mistakes. So that we might not fall into the same type of traps that they did. And then he says in verse 12, "Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." Now here we see a warning against self-confidence. And this was a major problem with Israel, really throughout their history. We see over and over again in the Old Testament where the children of Israel would come to a place, or one of their kings would come to a place that through their self-confidence, they would cease to rely upon the Lord. And in their ceasing to rely upon the Lord, that they would find themselves falling miserably. We see this also in the life of Peter. This is one of the things that led to his denial, his denying of the Lord. Peter's problem was his self-confidence. Remember, it was him who boasted on that night. There in the upper room when Jesus said that this night all of you are going to deny me. All of you are going to forsake me. And Peter stands up and says, "Lord, though all the rest of these guys forsake you, not me. Lord, I am with you to the end, man. I'm rock. You can count on me. I'm Peter, you know." But that was part of Peter's problem. And that very night, he denied his Lord three times. Now, two other things that we see that were a part of Peter's problem was that he followed the Lord at a distance there on that night. And thirdly, he warmed himself at the enemy's fire. Now, what's interesting, Paul hits on all three of these things in this section of Scripture that we're looking at tonight. Paul warns against each one of these characteristics: self-confidence, following the Lord from afar, and getting too close, too comfortable amongst the enemy. The first principle, though, is that of spiritual pride, confidence in self. And Paul says, "Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." Guys, if you ever find yourself saying to yourself or to someone else, "Now that's a sin there, I don't have to worry about that. That area of temptation, hey, that's not a problem. I would never fall in that way." Watch out when you start thinking in that way, because you're in trouble. The minute that you start thinking, you know what, hey, that's not a problem with me, watch out. Because the enemy is so good at coming and attacking in that area that we perceive as being a strength. You know, oftentimes when we think, you know, hey, this area of my life, you know, I really have to pay close attention to this. It's interesting, that's not where he comes and attacks. But it's in that area where we think, you know, hey, I can relax here. I can be comfortable here. This doesn't matter. It's in that place that we find that's where he comes. In the place where you never thought that you would fall. In Proverbs chapter 16, verse 18, if you're taking notes, Solomon writes, "Pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall." Upon hearing of a minister who sinned in an area of marital infidelity, Pastor Brian and I made a pact that we would thoroughly beat each other up if either of us ever did such a thing. Got to be careful. Take heed, Paul says. To him who thinks he stands, you know, every single one of us is capable of committing a hideous offense against the Lord. That's why we need to be so on guard, watching our hearts, guarding against pride, guarding against those things that would creep into our hearts and cause us to drop our guard or become so relaxed. That's when we find ourselves falling. Listen to these words from Ray Stedman. He says, these things are given in the Old Testament as types and pictures. That is, when you read these Old Testament stories, put yourself there. The enemies that they faced are answered by the enemies that we face. There are principalities and powers of darkness that are seeking to overcome us, assault us, discourage us, and defeat us, just as Israel was defeated and discouraged. They are types, and according to verse 12, they were targets, and we are too. Now listen to this part. We are under attack. We are not living in a beautiful, pleasant world designed for our enjoyment, and the quicker we get rid of that idea, the better. We are in a battlefield under attack. We are running a race that must be won. We are fighting a battle with a clever and ruthless enemy, and we must never forget it because his devices are clever and his strategies are very subtle, and we can easily fall. Some very wise words by our brother Stedman, who has since gone home to be with the Lord. Now, understanding that, the fact that, hey, to him who thinks he stands, take heed lest he fall. Then Paul writes in verse 13, no temptation has overtaken you except such as common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond which you are able. But with the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it, he says. Now, the word temptation here can also be translated trial or testing. In fact, it is used that way in other passages. One, for instance, is James chapter 1, verse 2, where it says, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. The word trial and testing there in James is the same word used here for the word temptation. So it tells us here that this word temptation has a broad basis of meaning, that it can refer to trial and testing as well as being tempted. Now, Paul gives us three important things that we need to note about our temptations and our testings. First of all, he says that they are common to all. The word common to man, or that phrase common to man, is actually one word in the Greek, and it simply means that which is human or characteristic of belonging to mankind. In other words, he's saying that these trials, these testings, these temptations, are there's no such thing as a superhuman or supernatural testing. Temptations or testings are human experiences. The term also carries the idea of them being just usual or typical. It's just kind of everyday stuff is what Paul's making reference to. That these temptations are not unique to us. Now, I know that that's a very hard thing to deal with when you're in the midst of a difficulty. When you're in the midst of a temptation or you're in the midst of a great trial or test, you know, the last thing that you think, I mean, you think, man, I'm the only one who's ever gone through this. Nobody knows the trouble I've seen, you know. Nobody knows my sorrow. But the truth of the matter is there's probably millions of people who have gone through the very same thing. We can never have a temptation that has not been experienced by others. The circumstances may differ, but the temptations do not. Now we might find ourselves thinking at times, well, why doesn't this happen to them? Man, that person deserves it a lot more than I do. You know, Lord, I've been trying so hard and they're flakes. You know, how come, you know, I'm going through this heavy situation? The answer to that is because it's your turn. Really. To put it real simple, it's your turn. We all go through them. It's a part of our growth. Everybody goes through it. Trials that are common to all, the first thing he says. Secondly, we face common trials, but know this, they are controlled trials. There's a limit to them. He says, God is faithful who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able. Or God is Faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted above your strength, is another way that that can be translated. Again, this is hard to believe when you are in the midst of it. We say, I'm already at that point of being beyond my strength. Lord, I can't take it anymore. Not another blow. Not another brick. The Lord says, no, you're not at your limit. You just think you are. You're not at that place of breaking. God knows your strength. He knows my strength. He knows it better than we do. He knows it better than us. He knows how much you can handle and how much you cannot handle. And you know, in of training and seeking to develop a person is to bring them to that place where they think they can't go any further. It's to bring them to that place. Any of you have ever done any weightlifting and you're working with that person who's spotting you, and you get to that point where it's like, you know, you're on number 8 and you think, I can't do anymore. And he says, yes, you can. Come on, you know. And with everything that's just aching in you, he's there holding the bar, you know. I mean, it's almost like a mental thing. He's not really doing anything, you know, but it's like he's letting you know, come on, you can do it. I'm here. I'm covering you. I'm spotting you. And you pull it out. You do those last two sets and you think, man, I didn't think I could do that. Well, in kind of the same way, the Lord does that with us. He brings us to that place where we think, Lord, man, I can't take another step. And he says, yeah, you can. My grace is sufficient. My power is made perfect in your weakness. Watch and see what I'm going to do in your life in this situation. But he'll never give us more than we can handle. But he takes us to that point where we think, man, I can't handle another thing, because he's seeking to grow us up and to build us up and to strengthen us and make us more and more dependent upon him. The third thing that we see here is that God always provides a way of escape. Now, what is that way of escape? Well, really, it varies. Think of the disciples out there on the Sea of Galilee. Interesting picture, because, you know, in Mark chapter 4, they freak out. Jesus is with them this time. He's in the boat. He's sleeping. And they think they're going to perish. They wake him up. God, don't you care that we're going to die? But this time they're in the midst of another storm. And it says they're straining at rowing against the wind. It's like they learned something from the two previous chapters and thinking, okay, you know what? Let's keep going. Come on, another stroke. I can see Peter, you know, stroke. And the other guys, okay, come on, we can do it, you know. And they're moving, you know, and they're not getting any headway, but they're trying. They haven't given up. And Jesus comes walking out to them on the water. And there we see, the way of escape was through divine rescue. God came and intervened in the situation. I love what G. Campbell Morgan says about that scene. He says, the very storm they found themselves in was the pavement of his victorious feet. I love that. Literally, their storm was under his feet. The thing that they thought was over their head and was going to be crashing on them was actually under his feet, the stepping stones of their growth and their understanding of who he was and his faithfulness in their lives. So sometimes that way of escape is through divine intervention. God comes and all of a sudden he pulls off the miraculous. But more often than not, especially as it relates to temptation, the way of escape is to not put yourself in the place of temptation. Let me give you an example. Let's say you are one who in the past has had a drinking problem before you came to Christ. And since you've come to the Lord, he's healed you. He's delivered you from that bondage to alcohol. Although there still is, you know, that temptation. Maybe when you're watching a ball game and one of the beer commercials comes on, that you find yourself going, man, that cold one, you know, sounds really good right now. And that temptation, you know, kind of comes there, says, you know what, hey, there, you know, they've got a big screen TV down at the, you know, sports bar down the street. You know, why don't you go down there and watch the game? Well, the way of escape is to not put yourself in the place of temptation. It's not to give in and to go hang out in that place where you would be very susceptible to falling. That's the way of escape. It's to flee. It's not to put yourself in that position to begin with. And so with that in mind, Paul writes in verse 14, "Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry." Idolatry was the sin that many in Corinth were being tempted to get involved in, to be hanging out in the temples where this idolatry was taking place. It was a part of their past life. Before they came to the Lord, it was a very pagan place. We've talked about that as we've gone through this study. So Paul says, look, flee from idolatry. Don't play around with it. Don't flirt with it. Don't think that you're strong enough to be in that place where it's happening. Flee. Now, for you and I today, you can insert into that whatever area of sin the devil tempts you with. The answer is not to flirt with it, but to flee from it. It's not, well, how much can I get away with and still be okay with the Lord? How close can I come to the edge without falling over? No. Paul says, flee. Get as far away from it as you possibly can. Escape, run. In 2 Timothy 2:22, he says, flee youthful lust and pursue righteousness, peace, and love with those who call upon the Lord out of a true heart. In other words, what Paul's saying, hey, flee the sin by pursuing after God, by pursuing after righteousness, and by getting yourself in a place where there's going to be others who are pursuing after the Lord as well. That's the key. This is the second fault that we saw that Peter fell into. He followed the Lord from afar. And that's the attitude, the heart of the person who's saying, you know, hey, let's see how close I can get to the world and still walk with the Lord. Let's see how close I can get and not walk over the edge. It's that person, you know, who's trying to live with a foot in both places. It just doesn't work. Paul says, don't flirt, don't play, flee. Anything that might hurt or harm my walk with the Lord can be considered as idolatry. And Paul says, get rid of it. Don't have anything to do with it. And then in verse 15, he says, I speak to the wise men, judge for yourselves what I say. Paul says, come on, you guys know better than this. You're not stupid. There's wisdom in this thing. There's wisdom in what I'm saying. Judge for yourself what I say if you haven't seen and found this to be true in your own lives. Times where you have fallen because you became self-confident, times where you were flirting with things that you should have been fleeing from, Paul's saying, here, judge what I'm saying. See that it's so. I think all of us in this room could hear what Paul's saying here and saying, yeah, that's right. I know the times in my life where I have fallen in areas of sin. It has been because of a self-confidence, always. And thinking, oh, you know, I don't have to worry about that. Or thinking, you know, hey, I'm okay. So Paul says, you know, judge for yourselves. There's wisdom in what I'm saying. And then he proceeds to give an interesting analogy, an illustration of why it is important to flee from idolatry. Verse 16, the cup of blessing which we bless, is it not the communion of the blood of Christ? The bread which we break, is it not the communion of the body of Christ? For we, though many, are one bread and one body. For we all partake of that one bread. Observe, Israel, after the flesh, are not those who eat of the sacrifices partakers of the altar? Now, the word communion here is an interesting word. It's the word for koinonia. It's the word which means a sharing in common, a sharing together. It's the word which speaks of fellowship. It speaks of the oneness that we share with Christ, the communion that we have with Christ, and the fellowship that we have with Christ. And that is the thing that Paul wants them to realize, is he's wanting them to catch the oneness that takes place at the communion table. The oneness that takes place as the elements are brought out, as we break bread together, as we partake of the cup together. There's a oneness. And in that culture, they believed that to eat with someone was the most intimate thing that you could do with them. That as you were partaking of the same loaf of bread and maybe dipping it into the same, you know, sauce and partaking of the same cup, that you were actually becoming a part of one another because you were assimilating the same things. That bread, that loaf of bread that is in me is also in you, and that drink that's in that cup that's going into me is also going into you. And so we're becoming one through this. There's a oneness that takes place. And he likens it to communion, that there's this oneness that takes place as I'm identifying myself with Christ. When I partake of the bread and of the cup, there's a oneness. Because the cup represents his blood, the bread represents his body, and there's a oneness that we experience through that act. And we also become not just one with the Lord, but one with each other as we all eat of the same bread, as we all drink of the same cup. There's a oneness that's taking place. And that oneness seen in the body of Christ through the act of communion is probably the most graphic illustration of the oneness that we have. That's why it's so special when we gather together here on the first Wednesday night of the month to participate and partake of communion. There's a oneness that's taking place. Now, especially though, in that day, because literally, you know, they weren't eating little crackers and drinking out of a bunch of little, you know, plastic cups, but they took a loaf and they ripped off pieces, passed it around the room, and they took a big cup and passed it around the room, and they all drank out of it. And there was a oneness that was taking place. So Paul uses communion as this illustration here. He's making a point, and then he also goes on to speak about that Israel understood this. That Israel understood the whole idea of bringing the peace offering and offering it to God was that of communion with God. So you bring it to the priest, and he would take it to the butcher, and he would cut a portion of the meat from that offering, that peace offering, and he would give it to you. And you'd take it out and you'd roast it and you would sit down and you'd eat. Now, you've brought part of it to be offered to the Lord, the fat and all that was taken and burnt on the altar. The smoke goes up. It's like a sweet savor to the Lord. And then the priest would take his portion, you would take your portion, and you'd sit down to eat. The idea was that you and God were becoming one through that peace offering. That there was peace between you and God, that God received his part, the priest his part, and you received your part, and you were becoming one. And that whole concept of becoming one and them eating together is what Paul is wanting them to focus on. He's wanting them to draw their attention to, because then he says in verse 19, "What am I saying then? That an idol is anything, or what is offered to idols is anything?" Paul here is reiterating what he said back in chapter 8. But he's doing it in asking a question form. In chapter 8, he says, look, an idol's nothing. It's just a piece of wood, piece of stone. Doesn't mean anything. Therefore, you can eat meat sacrificed to an idol, sold there in the shambles. It doesn't matter. But now Paul's going to give a new implication here. Look at verse 20. "Rather, that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to have fellowship with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the Lord's table and of the table of demons." Now here's the key. Paul says that an idol is nothing, but now here he says, but behind the idol is a demon. Behind the idol is a demonic entity. Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 17 is just one of many scriptures in the Old Testament, which gives this idea that behind the idol is a demonic being. Behind the idol is a demonic force. And Paul says that it's true, the idol is nothing, but behind the idol is a demon. And you don't want to have any fellowship, any communion with demons. Now, is Paul contradicting himself here? Listen closely. In chapter 8, he's saying, hey, an idol's nothing. Eat the meat sacrificed to an idol. It's no problem. But now he's saying that behind the idol is a demon, and you can't drink of the cup of the Lord and the cup of a demon. So what's the deal? Paul, what are you saying? Here's the answer. And I think this is a good way to remember what Paul is saying here. It's really quite simple. Meat is not the problem. Meat is not the problem. It's the meeting that's the problem. You see, the meat that's sacrificed to the idol that's sold in the shamble, Paul says, hey, it's no problem. That's not the issue. The issue is the meeting. You see, some of them were going to the temple where the sacrifices were taking place. And they were actually seeking to buy that meat right then and there. They were seeking to go and maybe not participate in the idolatry taking place, but to sit down afterwards and eat a meal with those. And Paul said, that's the problem. The meat isn't the problem. It's the meeting place. That's the problem. And that was Peter's problem. The third thing in Peter's life is he warmed himself at the enemy's fire. And that's what Paul's talking about here. If you buy a piece of meat in the shambles in the outdoor markets that may have been offered to an idol, hey, it's no problem because an idol is nothing. But if you're hanging out at the temples where idolatry is taking place and you're eating of that meat, now that's a problem. It's not the meat, but it's the meeting place. Because behind the idol is a demonic being. And what you're doing is you are in the enemy's camp. You are in a place where you are vulnerable to be deceived and to stumble. Now, what's the application for us today in this? The application for us today is that I might say, well, you know what? I can go down to the bar. I can go down to the party. And I can say, you know, I'm not going to go and I'm not going to drink anything. I'll just have a Diet Coke. But I can go. I have liberty to go and be in that place, right? Well, Paul would say wrong. Because you see, you're putting yourself in a place where devilish activity is taking place. You're putting yourself in a place where demonic activity is happening. You're putting yourself in a place where the works of the flesh are very, very evident. What are the works of the flesh? Paul lists them in Galatians chapter 5. Listen, now the works of the flesh are evident, which are adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lewdness, idolatry, sorcery. Also, the word from which, in the Greek, pharmakia, from which we get our word pharmacy or pharmaceutical, relating to drug use. Hatred, contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, dissensions, heresies, envy, murders, drunkenness, revelries, and the like, of which I tell you beforehand, just as I told you in time past, that those who practice such things will not inherit the kingdom of God. And Paul says, you know, when you're in that place where the demonic activity is taking place, where you're in that place where the demonic, the demons are present. And they're present in those places. Paul says, watch out, avoid such a place because it's the devil's playground. When I was in college, a freshman in college, a bunch of us from the college that I was going to, it's a Christian school down in Costa Mesa. And we were going to the movies one night down in Lido Isle. And we got to the show and it was sold out. And so one of the guys suggested that we go to this club called The Warehouse. He said, there's good music there. Let's go there and we'll wait for the next show. So about 10 of us went and piled into this place and sat down. And there was an awesome band playing that night. They were incredible. And I got so just enthralled in the music. I thought, man, this is a happening place. I really didn't pay much attention to what was going on. I like music and I was just really into the band that night. But a couple weeks later, we're sitting around, hey, what do we do tonight? Hey, let's go to the warehouse. Let's go, you know, check it out. And this night, the band stunk. They were horrible. And so I had the opportunity to kind of, you know, being bored stiff because of you know, the music that was so bad, to kind of, you know, have my eyes opened up a little bit, what was going on. And it was sickening. All the games being played, all the come-ons taking place, all the little, you know, stuff happening. Guys trying to get a girl and girls trying to get a guy and just people getting drunk. And I suddenly felt so very uncomfortable. Such a sense of, man, I don't belong in this place. I don't belong here. That's what Paul's saying here. It's not the meat, it's the meeting, it's the place. It's putting yourself in that place. Now, some people argue and say, well, hey, Jesus hung out with, you know, sinners and prostitutes and publicans and Democrats and, you know, all of those people. But here's the thing. When Jesus was ever in a situation like that, he was the focus of the party. He was the focus of the meeting. And I can guarantee you that there wasn't, you know, drunken revelry taking place. It wasn't like, you know, hey, Jesus, pass me another brew. You know, that wasn't what was happening there. The sinners were gathered around because they realized, man, we got to hear. We got to listen. We got to meet with this guy. So Paul says the meat, no problem. The meeting place, the temple where the idolatry is happening, there's the problem. You may have liberty to buy a steak at the temple where demonic activity is taking place, but it's not wise. You might think that, hey, I have liberty to go hang out in this place, even if I'm just buying Cokes, but it's not wise. You can't go drinking of the cup of demons and the cup of the Lord, Paul would say. And then he says in verse 22, and do not provoke the Lord to jealousy. Are we stronger than he? Now, what does this mean, God being jealous? What's Paul talking about here? You know, we get jealous because we feel threatened, but God is jealous. When God is jealous, it's a totally different situation. He's jealous for us. He's jealous for you and for me. You see, he doesn't want us to get hurt. He doesn't want us to miss out on anything that he has for us. It's the same thing when it talks about do not grieve the Holy Spirit. He, you know, when someone does something wrong to me or my family, I get grieved, but it's all personal. Man, I can't believe they did that. Can't believe they said that. And it's like, you know, self-pity kind of a thing. When God grieves, it's because his kids are missing out on what he has for them. And so his heart grieves because he sees little Johnny or little Joey or little Rob going and saying, you know, oh man, he's missing it. And his heart aches. He gets jealous for us in that same way. Here's an analogy I heard that I think is a good one. Let's say that you were watching the news and you saw on the news that Flash, some guy, police are looking for, FBI, he's, you know, on that list of America's most wanted. Mass murderer. And you notice that he's here at the church. And you see him talking to one of the sisters in the fellowship that's single. Maybe he goes and hangs out at the college group. And you come to that gal and you say, you know what? You got, this guy's bad news. You got to stay away from him. And she says, oh, you're just jealous. Well, you're not jealous of this guy, but you're jealous for her. You're concerned about her. You don't want to see her become, you know, his next victim. That's what Paul's talking about here concerning the Lord. He doesn't want us see us become the devil's next victim. Now, Paul concludes this whole teaching by giving five principles to remember for using Christian liberty. We're going to go through these rather quickly. The first is edification over gratification. Verse 23, all things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but not all things edify. All things are lawful, Paul says, but all things are not helpful. They're not expedient. Let's say it's one of these rainy nights that we've been having lately. It's been raining cats and dogs. And you've got to go out to the 15, so you head down Vista Way to Gopher Canyon, and the speed limit says sign there says 45 miles an hour. And it's coming down. It's raining heavy. And you start going 45 miles an hour down Gopher Canyon. Now, is it lawful for you to do that? Yes. Is it wise? No. It's stupid. Paul says, look, all things are lawful, but all things are not wise. It's not wise. It's not wisdom. Yeah, you can do that, but you know what? Going 45 miles an hour on a rainy night on Gopher Canyon, chances are you're going to end up on the side of the hill. All things are lawful. Seek to be doing that which is going to edify. Edification over gratification. How's it going to build me up? How's it going to edify me? Second, others over self, verse 24. Let no one seek his own, but each one the other's well-being. Now Paul says here, not only do I need to consider is it going to edify me, but will it edify others as well? How's it going to affect them? Now there's a real issue in this. I mentioned last week, Patrick Henry said, give me liberty or give me death. And Paul probably would have said, right on, Patrick. But then he would also add, give me liberty, but make sure it doesn't lead to death. Death in the life of one of my brothers and sisters. And what we've seen here, what Paul has illustrated for us is that Christian liberty, an aspect of it means a death, a dying to self, a dying to the flesh in those areas where it might mean that, hey, I could get a lot of fleshly gratification in this particular thing, but it's not going to edify me or build me up at all in the Lord. So I'm going to choose that which is going to edify, and I'm going to die to my fleshly desires, but also a dying to self. Because, yeah, I might have liberty in this area to do this thing, but because it might stumble my brother or sister, I'm not going to do it because I want to see them built up, and I don't want to do anything that might cause them to stumble. I read the story of a pastor who was preaching on this passage, and he had a time of testimony where he asked the congregation to share experiences of giving up something for the sake of someone else. Well, except for one man who said that he did not drink or smoke anymore, no one else responded. Well, after the service, a number of the people came up and they told the pastor, they said, you know, for the first time in my life, I realized that I don't really give up anything for the sake of others. The second thing here that Paul says is let no one seek his own, but each one the other's well-being. This was the problem that the church had in Philippi. Paul writes to them and he says, do nothing from selfish ambition or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, let each of you regard one another as more important than himself. And do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also the interests of others. The third thing that we want to note is liberty, exercising liberty over legalism. Verse 25, eat whatever is sold in the meat market, asking no questions for conscience' sake. For the earth is the Lord's and all of its fullness. If any one of those who do not believe invites you to dinner and you desire to go, eat whatever is set before you, asking no question for conscience' sake. Paul says, look, you have liberty. You can eat what's sold in the marketplace. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness of it, he says. Meat, God made it. Enjoy it. That's what Paul's saying. If somebody invites you over, don't ask them where it came from. Just, hey, man, can I have some seconds? Pile it on. Eat it. Enjoy it. And he says, you know, basically what he's saying is what you don't know won't hurt you. You know, your conscience is not going to be affected if you, you know, realize, hey, this, you know, it wasn't offered to an idol. Because there were those, as I said before, who had a problem. Oh, man, what if this, you know, eat is... And could you imagine those people with each, you know, little cut of the knife looking at that steak? I wondered if this was sacrificed to an idol or not, you know? You know, kind of like your kids when they don't want to eat something, you know, it's like, you know. Paul says, don't do that. Somebody invites you over, they put down some steak down. Don't worry about where it came from. Just eat it. Just enjoy it. Liberty over legalism. Don't come across like one who is all bound up. Now, brother, where'd you get this meat? Especially, you know, if it's an unbeliever, he says, if somebody who's not a believer, they need to see how free you are, Paul's, you know, making the point. But then he says this, the fourth thing, we need to exercise our conscience over condemnation. But if anyone, verse 28, says to you, this was offered to idols, do not eat it for the sake of the one who told you and for conscience' sake. For the earth is the Lord's in all of its fullness. Conscience, I say, not your own, but that of the other. For why is my liberty judged by another man's conscience? But if I partake with thanks, why am I evil spoken of for food over which I give thanks? Now, Paul says, look, if the unbeliever says to you, or if someone says to you, hey, this has been offered to an idol. Paul's saying, look, he's testing you. He's wanting to see what you're going to do. So don't eat it. And then he gives that quote again, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Now, is Paul contradicting himself here? No, I think what he's saying is in the first place where he says that concerning, yeah, eat the meat, it's the Lord's. And the second place where he says, now look, if somebody does make it known to you, they're testing you on this thing, they want to see what you're going to do, don't eat it. The earth is the Lord's, meaning, hey, there's a lot of other things you can eat. There's a lot of other stuff that God made. You know, dig into the vegetables that night and enjoy. That's what Paul's saying. And the last thing, the fifth thing, verse 31. Therefore, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. That's it right there. Whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Now, is Paul being double-minded here? If you're going to eat... or whether you're not going to eat. No, I think what Paul's being here is spirit-directed. As the Lord leads you in whatever situation you are, just make sure that what you're doing is for His glory. That's going to bring Him glory. And then he says in verse 32, give no offense either to the Jews or to the Greeks or to the church of God. And just as I also please all men and all things, not seeking my own profit, but the profit of many, that they may be saved. And then verse 11, or chapter 11, verse 1, should actually be the last verse of chapter 10. It's the most logical division. Imitate me just as I also imitate Christ. Paul brings them back to the gospel. Brings them back to his heart that, hey, what I'm thinking about, what I'm considering in these matters is others and the impact of the gospel. So imitate me as I imitate Christ. Let's stand together.